Welcome to the After the Supreme Court, What's Next for Fairmaps conference call. My name is Adrienne, and I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-answer session. During the question-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please note this conference is being recorded. I'll now turn the call over to Sandhya Badija. Sandhya, you may begin.
Thank you, Adrienne. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sandhya Badija, the Chief Communications Officer at Campaign Legal Center. Thank you all for joining us today to discuss, after the Supreme Court, what's next for Fairmaps. As you all know, the Supreme Court issued a decision in CLC's groundbreaking case on partisan gerrymandering, Gill v. Whitford, sending the case back to the lower court for further consideration. As we continue to litigate this case, states across the country are taking the fight for fair maps into their own hands. Advocates are pushing for the creation of independent redistricting commissions and litigation tackling unconstitutional gerrymanders in state courts are taking hold. Citizens are mobilized and energized, and they are saying that democracy is where voters, not lawmakers, choose their elected officials. Today, we will hear from experts on these issues, who have worked on both federal and state litigation, as well as advocated for redistricting commissions in their own states. CLC is also releasing two reports today, one for state advocates on how to design an effective independent redistricting commission, and another that focuses on challenging gerrymanders in state courts as another litigation avenue. CLC's reports discussed today will be available on our website and will also be emailed to you within 24 hours of this call. After we hear from all the speakers, we will open the conversation up for Q&A from the audience. Now I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Ruth Greenwood, CLC Senior Legal Counsel, Voting Rights and Redistricting. At CLC, Ruth litigates a variety of redistricting cases with a particular focus on ending partisan gerrymandering and promoting minority representation. Ruth represented plaintiffs in both the Gill v. Whitford and League of Women Voters North Carolina v. Rucho partisan gerrymandering cases that went to the Supreme Court. Ruth, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Sandhya. Hello, everybody. So I thought I would give you a brief overview of the federal litigation space before we move into hearing from all of our wonderful allies about what's going on in the states. You may have heard, you know, the Supreme Court, the word they used a lot was punted on partisan gerrymandering. As Sandhya said, they sent it back both the Gill v. Whitford case out of Wisconsin, which is a case about state legislative maps, and also the League of Women Voters versus Rucho, which is also a companion case to the Common Cause versus Rucho case out of North Carolina, which deal with congressional maps. Both of those cases were sent back for additional consideration. The North Carolina court is actually moving fairly quickly. They issued an order yesterday. They issued an order 2 weeks ago asking for briefing from the parties to find out what additional evidence may be needed on the question of standing. We then filed briefs last week and some additional evidence. And the court yesterday suggested that it wanted to have sort of additional depositions in the next 2 weeks and then to go back to the court in August. So it seems as though that case is moving quickly. Obviously, there's a lot of briefing and jockeying between the sides, but both the League of Women Voters and Common Cause plaintiffs should end up with a decision in the next 2 months, we think, and then that decision can be appealed to the Supreme Court, which makes it likely that the issue of congressional partisan gerrymandering will go back to the Supreme Court during the 2018 term. In Wisconsin, we are still waiting for the case to formally go back to the state, to the our three-judge court, and then we will have to amend our complaint. The difference is in North Carolina, we have plaintiffs in all over all of the districts, right? So we can challenge all of the districts. In Wisconsin, we have 12 individuals who were representing Democrats across the state. We are now going to expand that to be potentially dozens more plaintiffs, so we can tell all of their individual stories about individual districts. It's important, I guess, to note in both cases that all of the evidence about statewide harms, including things like the partisan asymmetry and the efficiency gap, all of that is still in the record, and we expect it to be part of the eventual decision. The real focus here is on the question of standing. Can we talk about individuals and how they have been affected by a partisan gerrymander? On the federal litigation front, there have been a couple of other cases filed. So a case in Ohio was filed within the last month, and then an amended complaint was filed after the Gilby-Whitford decision came down. And so that case is alleging that the congressional districts are a partisan gerrymander, and I presume will proceed. And in Michigan, a case had been filed over a year ago, and there are additional arguments going on as to whether they can challenge the state House, state Senate, and congressional districts. Ben will talk to you later about how Pennsylvania keeps trying to turn their state case into a federal one. So the point is there is ongoing federal litigation. I've been fighting these cases for 4 years, and I'm certainly not giving up. I know that the composition of the court has changed. We know that obviously Justice Kennedy has retired, but in the decision that we got in Gilby-Whitford, we had six justices. We had seven justices, excluding now Justice Kennedy, six who said, look, we want to hear more about standing and we're not taking any position on the rest of your case. You know, we'll hear it again later. Thomas and Gorsuch said they would have completely dismissed the case. So we think that's good. You know, we can work with six justices. In fact, we only need five. And we think that we can explain all of the individual harms and also go into more detail on the vote dilution concept that the court seems to understand in the opinion that it issued. So we are moving full steam ahead, but we also recognize that federal litigation can only get you so far, right? This litigation is very specifically to stop extreme partisan advantage. But there are many other things that you may want from a redistricting system. And so we've always been incredibly supportive of independent commissions. And so I'm going to hand it over to Annabelle Harless, my colleague, who has done all of this litigation with me, but who also has helped to advise people who you hear on this call, like Josh and Katie from Colorado and Michigan, but also people in many other states, about what you can do with an independent commission to try to promote fair districts across multiple metrics. So, Fandi, I think you're going to introduce Annabelle formally.
Sure. So Annabelle Harless is our next speaker, and she joined CLC in 2016. She also represented plaintiffs in both the partisan gerrymandering cases before the Supreme Court last term. Annabelle has also helped to advise groups in several states on language aiming to create independent redistricting commissions for state legislative or congressional redistricting. So Annabelle, you're up.
Thanks, Sandhya, and hi, everyone. So as Ruth explained, while we continue to work in the courts to set a standard curbing partisan gerrymandering, state efforts to reform both state legislative and congressional redistricting are ongoing and especially important. Independent redistricting commissions are one of the most effective ways to curb the undue influence of partisan legislators drawing district lines. CLC has been working with groups across the country who are pushing for change through ballot initiatives that improve the redistricting process. These states include several that will either have or are aiming to have redistricting reform proposals on the ballot in 2018. Colorado and Utah both will have redistricting reform measures on the ballot this fall. Colorado's measures include a set of constitutional amendments aimed at improving both the state legislative and congressional redistricting process. I'll leave it at that because we have Josh Penry on the call to discuss further. Utah's proposal would amend the Utah Code rather than the state constitution. The measure would establish a redistricting commission with members appointed by various top elected officials in the Utah government. The proposal also lays out several criteria for both the commission and the legislature to follow when drawing district lines, including protections for communities of color and provisions that require partisan fairness. Additionally, The proposal provides for transparency in the redistricting process, including a requirement that computer software and data be available so that the public and reform groups can review any proposed redistricting plans. Michigan will also have a constitutional amendment establishing a citizen redistricting commission to draw district lines on the ballot pending a Michigan Supreme Court challenge. Katie Fahey, who has spearheaded the Michigan effort, will discuss the Michigan initiative further later in this call. Missouri also has a constitutional amendment, which is part of a larger government reform package and has gathered enough signatures and is only awaiting certification of the Secretary of State. The Missouri amendment would put a state demographer in charge of redistricting and puts in place important criteria such as partisan fairness. And Ohio voters already approved a constitutional amendment that will improve the redistricting process for congressional districts starting in 2021. Two other states, Arkansas and Oklahoma, are attempting to get redistricting reform on the ballot but have not yet qualified. And finally, several other states, including Pennsylvania, Virginia, Illinois, and Wisconsin, are or were trying to reform the redistricting process and establish redistricting commissions through the state legislature. Ben Geffen, who is on this call, will discuss Pennsylvania's experience. Earlier this year, Ruth Greenwood and myself, along with CLC fellows Blair Bowie and Shakia Wright, published an up-to-date and comprehensive guide called Designing Independent Redistricting Commissions. This guide is meant for good government groups, advocates, or even legislators who are interested in drafting language or thinking about establishing independent redistricting commissions for state legislative or congressional districts. The guide provides readers with three critical tools. First, it provides information on the basics of redistricting and defines and explains key concepts and terms used in the field. Second, it outlines policy options and considerations to keep in mind when designing an independent redistricting commission, including examples of constitutional or statutory language used in existing or proposed commissions. Designing an independent commission involves a series of decisions about how to build a system that will incentivize the creation of fair maps. The guide aims to lay out these options and decisions for groups to consider, along with the state's current redistricting process, best practices, and the political climate of the state. Finally, the guide outlines the different criteria that commissions must and can consider when drawing district lines and gives examples of statutory language for these criteria. There are certain criteria that all line drawers must follow, like the Voting Rights Act, which protects against minority vote dilution, and the one-person, one-vote rule, which requires equal population. There are also criteria that many states require, but that vary by state, including things like compactness, contiguity, subdivision splits, and communities of interest. And then there are what the guide calls fairness criteria, things like partisan symmetry, competitiveness, and responsiveness. The guide discusses all of these. And lastly, the guide includes an appendix that identifies current state legislative and congressional redistricting commissions, classifies them by types, and explains their operation. The appendix is meant to be a quick tool for analyzing state redistricting commissions. The guide is available in PDF form on CLC's website, www.campaignlegal.org. And that's it for me.
Thanks, Annabelle. And yes, both of our reports are available right now, but we will be sending them to everyone on this who has RSVP'd within 24 hours, as well as a recording of this call. And now I'd like to kick off our state strategy section. Our first speaker in this area is Josh Penry, who will speak about efforts in Colorado. Josh has run some of the most successful congressional and ballot initiative races in the country. As chief strategist for Congressman Mike Kaufman's landslide victories in 2014 and 2016, both efforts were hailed as among the best campaigns in the country by Roll Call and National Journal. So I'd like to pass it on to you, Josh.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for the chance. Thanks for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. First of all, a special nod to Campaign Legal Center for their leadership on this issue. Across the country and in Colorado, as I'll talk about in a minute, this conversation has been going on in this state for about 3 years now in earnest, and it's been tricky and complicated. And CLC has really redeemed itself, I think, in the eyes of both sides as being an arbiter of good information, good thought, and they're focused on the policy. sort of irrespective of what it might mean with partisan political implications. So they've been a really fair broker and really wonderful asset to the effort in Colorado. Colorado has a rich history of combat-centric redistricting and reapportionment. We've had really difficult, bruising fights in this state each of the last three cycles. I'm a former legislator myself. Was in the state house and state senate, and after the last round, it's the same story as it is in other parts of the country. Sort of whichever party has happens to have done well in the immediately preceding election, they kind of get the upper hand in the end. There was a lot of fatigue on both sides of this issue among the legislators. I would say among the political class, people who viewed it and saw the process. And just sort of as a quick backdrop, and so you can understand where it was, the legislature in Colorado is in charge of reapportionment, drawing legislative maps. We have an independent commission that's in charge of, the legislature is in charge of drawing congressional maps. We have an independent commission that's in charge of drawing the legislative maps. But the independent commission is itself appointed by members of both parties, and so it becomes a very hyper political process. And each of the last three redistricting cycles, we round up in litigation and a judge essentially deciding the issue for us. So tremendous fatigue after this last cycle, and not just among sort of like centrists, among honestly the sort of the hardened partisans on both sides just think that this process has coalesced around the notion that this process is deeply flawed. Beginning in 2016, there was a group of what I refer to as largely has-beens, former legislators, who said there must be a better way. Colorado is a growing state. We're picking up an additional congressional seat. We're a battleground state. There's got to be a better way to go about doing this. And so that effort started, but it was kind of it was definitely not one where it was all morning in America. There were a group of largely progressive organizations who thought that proposal missed the mark. So 2016, a long story short, the Supreme Court ruled that the measure couldn't qualify for the ballot on single subject sort of technical grounds. In the intervening period, the League of Women Voters and other, I think, well-regarded organizations, civic organizations, got involved in the effort. Sort of flashing forward, rather than go to the ballot with something that wasn't broadly supported, a group of what I would unquestionably describe as statesmen and stateswomen said, let's figure this one out together. And so there was a bipartisan group of negotiators, some of the most prominent Republicans and Democrats and independents in the state, led by Kent Theory, attempted to put together a proposal that got the redistricting and reapportionment process out of the political space and put it in the hands of an independent commission with the job of drawing lines that are more objective, more reflective of the actual will of the voters of the state, and gets Colorado out of the business of gerrymandering once and for all. And so that negotiation happened for weeks and weeks and weeks, and we were able to reach a compromise in what truly is a bipartisan effort. We have all of the state's living governors. The legislature referred this measure to the ballot on a 100-0 basis. All of the major civic and nonprofit and political groups, left, right, and center, have endorsed the measure. It's a pretty actually remarkable story, given how Colorado's a swing state. It's pretty tough to find solid bipartisan ground, and we have it here. Let me spend a minute talking about the proposal, and then I think I'll pass it back to the group. The proposal itself is vetted. I mean, it was negotiated at sort of such tremendous length that it really has become a really well-vetted and smart policy. And so for those of you looking at potential approaches for your state, I'd encourage you to look at what Colorado has done. Essentially what we did is we created two independent commissions, one for redistricting and one for reapportionment, equally divided between Republicans, Democrats, and independents. It's essentially a third, a third, a third. As you wrestle with these choices, I'm sure CLC, and I know CLC's documents talk about this, the critical issue is how do you make sure that you have objective and fair appointees to that process. I mean, if you've got essentially wolves in sheep's clothing, masquerading Republicans and partisans and masquerading Democratic partisans who are all over this commission, you're going to get a lot of the same. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about how can we build checks and balances to make sure that the right mix of characters get on this commission. And so we did that. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time talking about that, although we can during the question and answer. Essentially, what will happen is these commissions will be formed, third Republican, a third Democrat, a third unaffiliated. Our nonpartisan legislative staff will take a first stab at a map, and there will be lots of public hearings, lots of public meetings, sunshine laws. By the way, as an asterisk, legislators and former lobbyists and a number of other party officials can't be on the commission, so it truly is a citizens' commission. They'll put that map on the table. In order for a final map to be approved, you need a two-thirds vote of the commission, including two of the unaffiliateds as well. So you essentially have a situation where what's happened historically in Colorado, and I suspect elsewhere, map drawing is the one time Republicans and Democrat incumbents sort of decide they can work together. Republicans agree to protect Democratic incumbents. Incumbents agree to protect Republican incumbents. And what you wind up with is a lot of uncompetitive seats. That's why we thought it was critical to not only have a two-thirds requirement of the commission, but also a requirement that the unaffiliateds vote, two of the unaffiliateds actually vote for it. So you can't have sort of a self-dealing scenario with the two parties. The structural incentive we created to induce compromise is that if they can't get to a two-thirds majority, then the legislative staff, the map that they drew, the second round of maps that they draw after the public comment phase, will be considered final. And so really these commissioners, we think we've created a process that will get fair and objective people who are qualified to go in there and make it, but they also have a strong structural incentive. Either get a deal or sort of render yourself powerless, and the nonpartisan legislative staff, which is widely regarded as being a very fair body, they'll get the final word. And so we're very proud of the proposal. The legislature in Colorado, there's two ways to get to the ballot. One is via referred measure, one is via signature collection. We were able to get a 100-0 referral from the General Assembly in an otherwise very partisan election. In Colorado, because these are both constitutional amendments, we'll have to get 55% of the vote. We've constructed a bipartisan team of really well-regarded Republicans and Democrats, pollsters, and vendors from kind of across the spectrum. It's the exercise unto itself, like putting aside how important substance has been really a redeeming moment for our politics and our state to get both sides working together on a proposal that we think will serve Colorado's interests over the long term. The final point I would say is, we've obviously followed in a very closely what's happening at the Supreme Court, and I know different states will have had different dogs in that fight and different aspirations for how it would come out. Our plan, the way we viewed it, the courts will do what the courts will do. We have people who support our proposal who agree with the Supreme Court decision. We have people who support our approach who loathe the Supreme Court's decision. I think what you've seen is a coming together around this notion of sort of whatever the broader legal ramifications are on gerrymandering or not, on what the courts will impose, we're going to do it better in Colorado. We're going to lay down our arms and find a way to create a playing field that's fair and competitive, an electoral process that represents the will of the voters and not the will of the voters as expressed through maps and lines that have been manipulated by one party or the other. So with that, I will turn it back to our hosts.
Okay. Thanks so much, Josh. Next up, we will hear from Katie Fahey on efforts in Michigan. Feeling that divisiveness in politics had reached a critical point following the 2016 election, Katie formed a 5,000-plus member grassroots organization called Count Michigan Vote, which became an umbrella organization that includes Voters Not Politicians and the Voters Not Politicians Ballot Committee. She is the executive director of the Voters Not Politicians Ballot Committee and has a passion for sustainability, public policy, and the state of Michigan. So, Katie, can you take it from here, please?
Yes. Hi. Thank you so much. I'm happy to expand or elaborate on anything during the question and answers. Our proposal and the reason I'm talking to you guys all today actually all stemmed from a Facebook post that I made shortly after the 2016 election when trying to think about an issue that I could go to the Thanksgiving table and not have everybody argue over. And ever since then, it's really been this grassroots movement focused on how do we come together as voters, as in our state, particularly Michiganders, instead of having to identify in a political party, and start to address some of the fundamental basic building blocks of our democracy, like redistricting, to start creating a government that we trust again and that we can trust the entire system. So from that Facebook post, yeah, we've been able to expand into thousands of people. And that's kind of where I'll start. You know, there had been a lot of great groups in Michigan who had been working on education around redistricting and the potential solutions to gerrymandering. But we really hadn't seen anybody kind of leading the charge. And so when our group came onto the scene, we saw a really big hunger for people who wanted to be able to talk about this and talk about solutions. So when we were crafting our policy, we had a small policy committee that did a very thorough history of what had been passed in Michigan and what had happened in other states. But, you know, we were still just a small group of people in a, you know, back room behind closed doors working on this. So we thought, why don't we take it to the people of our state? And what we did is we held what we called a town hall, where we would talk about what is happening in redistricting in our state, what has it historically looked like, what's happening in other states. And then the second part, which I think is the most important part, was a very long survey and discussion around, if we don't like politicians being in charge of drawing their own district lines, what would we like instead? What do the people of Michigan want? And so we gathered feedback from thousands of people. We did 33 town halls in 33 days, asking those fundamental questions, trying to make sure we were inviting different, as many constituency groups as we could, but also just regular voters. And those surveys told us a couple different things. In Michigan, we're consistently ranked one of the least transparent states when it comes to transparency in our government. And we definitely saw that from the people of Michigan just wanting a process that they understood how these decisions are being made. We heard very clearly that lobbyists and current politicians, that the people of Michigan did not want them involved, that they wanted a commission that actually looked like regular folks, that representative of the different parts of our state. And then lastly, a system that was impartial, that our government, I'm sure many of you have heard of the Flint water crisis, and that was partially caused from an emergency manager law that the people tried to repeal and then our government, you know, reinstated. And so there's been a lot of citizen efforts where people have tried to do things and then it doesn't directly work out. And then also they wanted a place for all people to be able to have a say. So much like the proposal that was just described, ours has, you know, Democrats, Republicans, and independent or third party coming together to have these discussions. And we had, you know, thousands of people help write that language too, whether they were, we had a birthing doula and a former mailman and lots of lawyers, of course. But it was a really wonderful example of how you can have people of different political backgrounds and interests be able to come together with one cause and purpose, working to focus on that and creating a solution together and being there for the right reasons, which is very reflective of what we see happening in these independent citizens redistricting commissions. So in Michigan, we've gone through the ballot proposal process, which means we wrote our language, submitted it, had to gather a lot of signatures. We gathered over 425,000 signatures in 110 days with all volunteer power. And we've now qualified for the ballot. We'll actually be going in front of the Michigan Supreme Court tomorrow. So we'll see how that goes. But just over a lawsuit trying to go after the kind of like a single subject rule. But we feel the Court of Appeals in Michigan gave a very strong ruling saying that our opposition's case is without merit. So we're looking very forward to headed to the November 6th election. So for our solution, in Michigan, we don't have people register what party they're a part of. So that was kind of a unique thing that when we were looking at other states and you have people apply to be these commissioners is really helpful so that you have some kind of guarantee that they are representing who they are. But we really heard from people, too, that they felt very strongly that they still wanted that party affiliation, but, you know, people needed to be able to self-identify. So we have pretty strict criteria for people who are disqualified around current legislators, closely affiliated family members, lobbyists, not being able to apply to be on this commission, and then people having to give an oath for which party they are part of, and a randomization process, actually, that tries to mimic the demographics of our state so that we don't get all of these independent commissioners from just Wayne County, for example, or Detroit is. Our commission will be made up of 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and 5 who affiliate with neither party or who affiliate with the third party. And the really key cornerstone of this proposal is that it's a completely transparent process, where everything down to, you know, the selection process to being able to go and give testimony to the commission will all be done in public, recorded, which is just the complete opposite of everything that happens in Michigan right now. The biggest part of where we see the enforcement of really creating a new system that can try to fix and address these things that have been wrong with the current Michigan process are with the criteria for drawing these maps. So, of course, it'll follow the federal laws like Equal Population and the Voting Rights Act. We do have that, you know, the maps must be contiguous. You can't have part of a district on one side of the state and part on the other. But we also include the communities of interest standard that you see in a lot of states so that we can keep shared cultural and historic or economic interests together, but with directly saying that a political party interest will be excluded from being considered. In the criteria, it directly states that one party cannot be given an unfair or disproportionate advantage, as well as any incumbent or candidate that is running for office. Having that in the Constitution will make it very clear cut that that is to be followed, which is more strict than what we have right now in our state. And then that the commissioners can consider existing political boundaries when drawing maps, including city and county lines, and then that they must be reasonably compact. They'll be required to hold meetings across our state before they even start drawing the maps to listen to people on their opinions on how they'd like to see their communities represented or how they'd like their representation to look. And then after drawing a couple maps, they'll go out and go back to the public to ask and receive feedback from that. Really a complete 180 from the current process where everything is kind of rushed through a giant list of census tracts that get voted on very quickly. Everything the commission does has to be published, everything down to the computer algorithms that are used to actually draw the maps. In order for the commission to agree on any maps, it's very similar to what Colorado's proposal was. At least 2 of the Democrats, 2 of the Republicans, and 2 of the third party or independents must all agree before adopting those maps. And then actually something that I really love, but that was really based on a lot of the feedback that we had heard from so many people when asking them what they wanted in the solution, is that the commissioners actually have to each individually write a report basically on why they're making the decisions they are and what kind of criteria are being used and the justification for, you know, the hundreds of decisions that are made on each map, which I think will, you know, the reason we heard that from the public is they just want to know why these decisions are being made and so that they can actually try and see if anything fishy is going on, but also like understand where the compromises need to be made. And it also provides a great public document to refer back to, which right now we have no ability to do. And really what this means for our state, I mean, Michigan is one of the most severely gerrymandered states in our country. We consistently vote about 50% for Democrats, about 50% for Republicans, yet depending which party has been in control of that process, can see upwards of, you know, 70% of allocated seats going to one party, which is a supermajority. But really being able to have that confidence back in our government, in our voting system, I think that's why we've seen support from people across the aisle, is because so many people are tired of feeling like our elections are manipulated or all decided in the primaries and want to be able to have some accountability there. So and we anticipate, with already still having, you know, thousands of volunteers right now, just thousands of people who will actually participate in the system, whether it's applying to be on the commission or whether it's showing up to those town halls to give testimony. And we're really excited to bring this to the Michigan voters in November.
Okay, thank you so much, Katie. Our final speaker today is Benjamin Geffen, and he will speak about efforts in Pennsylvania. And just a reminder, after Benjamin speaks, we will be opening this up for Q&A, and the operator at that point will give instructions of how you can ask a question. But to introduce Benjamin, Benjamin has been a staff attorney at the Public Interest Law Center in Philadelphia since 2010. His voting-related work at the Law Center has included a successful challenge to Pennsylvania's gerrymandered congressional map, as well as a lawsuit that struck down Pennsylvania's voter ID law. At the Law Center, Benjamin also successfully litigated numerous cases in federal and state courts about Medicaid, disability rights, and employment discrimination against people with criminal records. Benjamin, if you could go ahead, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll talk about a couple topics. First, I'll discuss the lawsuit that successfully challenged the congressional plan in Pennsylvania, and then I will talk about the frustrating efforts to amend our state constitution to create an independent commission. The lawsuit was filed just over a year ago on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Pennsylvania and 18 individual voters, one from each congressional district, and it was a challenge to Pennsylvania's gerrymandered 2011 congressional plan. We co-counseled with the law firm of Arnold and Porter on that case.
Even though Pennsylvania is closely split between Republicans and Democrats, our state legislature drew the 2011 congressional map with the intent and the effect of guaranteeing that Republicans would always win 13 out of the 18 congressional seats. And we brought our case exclusively under the Pennsylvania Constitution in state court here in Pennsylvania. We learned a great deal from Campaign Legal Center's work in the Wisconsin and North Carolina federal cases. And building off the legal theories in those cases, we asserted claims that the Pennsylvania map violated the state constitution's guarantees of equal protection, free expression, free association, and free and equal elections. And it's notable that these state constitutional provisions either don't have any precise counterpart in the U.S. Constitution or have been interpreted by Pennsylvania courts as giving citizens greater protections than their federal analogs. And that's significant because it means that it's exclusively a state constitutional question, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court would have the final word in interpreting it. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court early this year ruled in favor of our clients. They held that the 2011 map violated the Pennsylvania Constitution's requirement for elections to be free and equal. The court found that the 2011 map subordinated neutral criteria such as compact districts, avoiding county and city splits, and so forth, and that the map had been drawn by subordinating these criteria in favor of partisan political considerations. After the legislature failed to timely pass a remedial map, the court, through a special master, drew its own map, which was a very fair map, and that's the map that was used in the May primaries in Pennsylvania and which will be used in the general elections in November. I don't know how much credit we can take for this, but there's been an unprecedented number of, at least in modern electoral history, unprecedented number of candidates, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, who ran in primaries all across Pennsylvania after this new map took effect. The defendants in our case included some Republican legislative leaders. As the case was reaching its conclusion, they twice asked the U.S. Supreme Court for an emergency stay to block the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's map from taking effect. They were denied both times. They are still pursuing a cert petition. It's too late for that to affect the 2018 election. It appears that they're shooting for 2020. Their argument is that a state court cannot draw a congressional map after finding that a map drawn by the legislature is unconstitutional. We expect that this third attempt to get the U.S. Supreme Court to reverse will meet the same fate as the first two attempts. And there's a line of Supreme Court cases, U.S. Supreme Court cases, going back to the early 1930s, consistently affirming the power of state courts to adjudicate the constitutionality under state constitutions of congressional plans and to draw remedial plans when the legislature fails to do so. And it's important also to note that the free and equal elections language from the Pennsylvania Constitution that the Supreme Court relied on appears in exactly the same form in about a dozen other state constitutions. And beyond that, there are another dozen or so states that have very similar provisions in their state constitutions. And every state constitution has some version of at least one of the state constitutional guarantees that we cited in our case, like free expression, free association, or equal protection. So this was the first case in which a state Supreme Court had struck down a map as an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander when the state constitution didn't contain any express prohibitions on partisan gerrymandering. But we believe that the case is in no way Pennsylvania, unique, that there are that the logic of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision is applicable in many other states as well under their state constitutions. Also talk about the effort in Pennsylvania to amend our state constitution. There was a campaign, it's still going on, called Fair Districts Pennsylvania, which is promoting an amendment to the state constitution that's modeled chiefly after California's amendment. And it would create an independent commission that would draw the congressional and the state legislative maps. It would be a bipartisan commission with assurances that the members would be representative of the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, independents, and that they would have all sorts of other diversity as well, including geographic diversity from across our state, which is has two big cities and is otherwise quite rural. It is very difficult to amend the Pennsylvania Constitution. There's no way to bypass the legislature to pass an amendment. The only way to amend it is for the legislature, both houses, to pass an amendment, and then to pass the same amendment again in their next session. So in other words, to pass it once, then for elections to occur for the State House and State Senate, and then for the new State House and State Senate to pass the exact same amendment again. And then after it passes through the legislature twice, it has to go on as a statewide ballot question at the next statewide election. So it's a multi-step process, and it takes years. And for the Fair Districts Amendment to pass in time for the next decennial redistricting, it would have to pass this year and again next year, and then go on the ballot in 2019 or 2020 and be approved by the voters. There was a ton of great grassroots momentum around this, and a majority of the members of the legislature signed on as co-sponsors of the proposal. Unfortunately, key legislative leaders and committee chairs opposed the amendment, and the session ended 2 weeks ago without passage of the bill. It's not technically dead yet. The governor could still call a special session, but in all likelihood, the amendment will not be passed, at least not in time for the next decennial redistricting. This is an effort that will continue, and given the degree of enthusiasm that it garnered all around the Commonwealth, I'm hopeful that in the next session something will get passed. Nonetheless, it would probably it's very unlikely that something will get passed in time for the post-2020 census redistricting cycle.
Okay, thank you, Benjamin. Before we open up to Q&A, let's open it up for Q&A if the moderator can give instructions, and then as we're teeing up some questions, I have a few follow-ups for our speakers.
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There'll be a delay before the first question is announced. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have an audio question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone, and we're standing by for questions.
Okay, great. Well, questions queue up. I just had a couple questions just to get us started. I was curious, just to get a little bit deeper into if I was a concerned citizen in my state, whatever state that may be, how would I go about getting this process even started if I wanted to pass an independent redistricting commission? How do I connect with the right people? How do I find out if this is already underway? What advice just would you give me to get this going?
Thanks, Andrea. This is Ruth. I can take that. Until a few years ago, I would have said go and raise a lot of money because it costs a lot to get these things on the ballot. But Katie has shown us that you can do this by gathering, volunteers to help you and get enough signatures to get on the ballot. That's in Michigan. And Josh has shown you in Colorado that with enough pressure, you can get your legislators to vote, 100 to zip, putting it on the ballot. So the first thing is to be enthusiastic and maintain optimism. Obviously, feel free to reach out to us at info@campaignlegal.org, and we can tell you if we know something that's already going on in your state. And then to work out the rules in your state, even just online resources like Ballotpedia are really useful. They tell you how you can do a ballot initiative in your state. And I guess also if we are not immediately responsive on info@campaignlegal, in our report, in the appendix at the end, we go through all of the commissions that are out there already in the various states. So you can find out if you already have one. And then if not, on Ballotpedia, work out what the requirements are for your state. But yeah, I'd say, throw up a choose your social media platform post and get some friends together to get started.
Okay, thank you.
This is Josh in Colorado. Just a slightly wider frame on that. I mean, one of this issue has become one that has real resonance. It has legs, and what's interesting is that 10 years ago, there was kind of like little reason for the people who control the power now, the key leadership types in the parties, to do an agreement that essentially divests their authority to someone else. I mean, it's a big ask, right? Asking the parties to walk away from their authority. There is such fatigue among the actors making decisions and obviously the public at large that I think things have really shifted, and we've seen that here in Colorado. So to me, one of the critical things is getting, like the League of Women Voters, finding organizations that have some reach within your state to begin a dialogue, and then getting smart, committed actors on both sides to sit down and have a conversation. What we found is it sort of took off, and the more we focus on the policy and the the right outcome and refined and improved the policy, the larger our coalition became. And from that, when you have a coalition and a policy, then the money tends to follow. You'll have there's just so much interest and so much at stake that we were able to bring individuals to the conversation, like Kent Theory, who was obviously he's the CEO of DaVita, very active in the initiative space, really came in and brought resources and an even tighter focus on finding compromise and common ground. So to me, I think it's easy to think like something like this is not possible because of the fatigue, because of just the sort of the hostility to the increasing polarization of politics. We found here that the sky is the limit in terms of bringing people together to find common ground.
That's great. Just one other question for our speakers before we open it up to the questions I think that are in the queue. I'm just curious because, we have a lot of different tracks going of litigation, passing, these ballot initiatives, getting independent redistricting commissions. Why are we not just focused, on getting IRCs in every single state? Given the Supreme Court and, those types of, what we faced already, why do we stick with the litigation and why is that important, if at all?
Thanks, Sandia. I'd like to take a shot at answering this one. So this is Annabelle at the Campaign Legal Center. Truly, independent commissions are great reforms, and we at CLC support them wherever we can, but not all states can or will implement or pass them. So, for example, some states don't have the ability to do citizen-initiated ballot measures, and as we've been discussing, this leaves going through the state legislature as the only option. which while it will work in some places, in other places it can be very difficult to get the state legislators to give up the power to draw districts. So one example is Illinois, where I live. There was a strong coalition, there was a policy, there was a large number of legislators who signed on, but again, the leadership wouldn't even put it up for a vote. And so it's just very difficult to get the reform through. And so litigation is still important at the federal and state level in order to set limits on gerrymandering for all map makers to follow, especially in states without independent redistricting commissions or other limiting criteria. And litigation doesn't replace state efforts, but it's another strategy for curbing self-interested legislators drawing district lines.
Okay. Thanks, Annabelle. If we can open it up now to the questions in the queue, please.
Thank you. Our first question comes from Susan Milligan. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks very much for doing this. So I'm from U.S. News and World Report, by the way. So this has been a problem since I was an intern reporter like 35, 36 years ago. Have you seen the gerrymandering get worse during that time? And secondly, are there states or regions where you feel like the process is more corrupt, for want of a better expression, or not transparent?
Right.
Hey, Susan, this is Ruth. I might take a first crack, which is, yes, we can quantitatively say that gerrymandering has got worse in recent years. We presented a lot of that evidence in our case in Wisconsin and North Carolina, even though we know that in the 70s and 80s in particular, it was Democrats who were terrible gerrymanderers, and more recently there have been more Republican gerrymanderers. Both sides have been awful all the time. and it's getting worse. And part of the reason that it's getting worse is because there is more polarization, right? People are more clearly Democrats or Republicans. There are not so many swing voters. And we have technology that can allow us to do, micro-targeting of individuals. So not only do you know how someone will vote, and then you can put them in a district and you can know how that district will perform over a range of electoral scenarios, right? So we know it's terrible. Thankfully, the response of people has been to recognize that it's bad. I mean, there have been lots of efforts to get independent commissions in the past. In California, it took them 5 goes before they eventually passed an independent commission. Hopefully, with all of the states going at the moment, they'll go through first time. Thank you very much. The thing is that we can make changes, and people are making changes. And we specifically said in our independent commission's report that there's no kind of one-size-fits-all. We didn't want to say, here's the one example of what you should do. There are some good examples out there, California, what they proposed in Michigan, what they proposed in Colorado, but every state needs to choose. And then in terms of states that are particularly bad, I mean, there's kind of a long list, places that are just not transparent at all. I live here in Chicago, Illinois, where they, released the map, a couple of days later, voted on the map, didn't let anybody have any public input or done. I've been litigating in North Carolina where the same thing happened. They released the map and then voted on it straight away. Lack of transparency is a real problem. We think, obviously, eventually you care about outcomes, but if you can fix the process, you can get almost all of the way there.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Kimberly Robinson. Please go ahead.
Hi. At the top of the call, you mentioned that there were 7 votes on the Supreme Court to send the case back to hear more evidence. I'm wondering if you have any idea how the president's nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, thinks about partisan gerrymandering.
Thank you. Yeah, we actually don't know what he thinks about partisan gerrymandering. He's never been asked to look at that issue. The D.C. Circuit rarely gets those cases, so we're not sure at all. We have seen sort of unhelpful record on campaign finance, which suggests that maybe he's not in favor of courts being involved in, promoting democratic government. I think we just have to wait and see. As I say, there are plenty of other justices that we think that you know, will do the right thing and uphold the Constitution over the sort of will of individual legislators trying to look after themselves. But yeah, we just can't really know what Judge Kavanaugh may do.
Thanks a lot.
And our next question comes from David Lee from the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, my question is for Benjamin. I was wondering, after your successful court case there in Pennsylvania, whether you have heard from people in other states sort of chatting you up about how you might be able, how they might be able to adopt your model to bring challenges in state courts there. So have you heard from other states, and if so, from where?
Yes, I heard from other states. I'm not sure I can give you a list right now, but there's definitely been interest from a number of other states. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's opinion itself listed 12 states, this is footnote 71 of their decision, where the identical wording appears in the state constitution. As I said, I think there are about a dozen or so other states that have very similar language. So there's the possibility of doing this elsewhere. In terms of what the timing of filing a lawsuit would be, I don't know if anyone is actively planning to file a lawsuit in time for a new map for the 2020 election, which would be the last election carried out under the current maps. Every state is going to be redrawing its maps after the 2020 census, and I expect that people will be keeping a very close eye on this around the country, and that's when this issue is really going to arise again in a lot of different places.
And our next question comes from Bill Aiecho from Harbor, Maine.
Yeah, this is Bill Eco. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So I have a question. You said that in North Carolina, you have plaintiffs from every affected congressional district. So why did the Supreme Court send it back with a question about standing if it's clear that you had plaintiffs with standing from every district?
Thanks, Bill. This is Ruth. That is a good question. Though we have people in all of the districts, we didn't have any findings from our district court as to whether there were individual sort of plaintiffs with standing, as in they hadn't considered it at all. The court had just said, yeah, you have people who are Democrats across the state. That's great. Moving on to the next question. And so we wanted to specifically go back and say, not even just we have somebody in every district, but we have a person who's in this part of this district and they're in a red district, but they could be in a blue district, or they're in a really packed blue district and they could be in a less packed blue district. That's all sort of outlined in our filing to the three-judge court in North Carolina from last week. So it wasn't so much that the evidence wasn't in the record, but there weren't any findings on that. And so we think that if the court can give some findings to suggest that there is standing, hopefully they'll agree with us, then we can go back up and have the merits considered.
I see. Okay, thank you.
And as a reminder to enter the queue and ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Star 1 to re-enter the queue or to ask a question. And we have Rick Yenser. Please go ahead.
Okay. My question is based on the 2011 redistricting here in Indiana that resulted in super majorities for Republicans in the Indiana State House. There have been efforts by League of Women Voters to get a bipartisan or nonpartisan commission set up, but they've been blatantly ignored by conservatives. And a result of this kind of gerrymandering has resulted in no contest races from local races like county and city races to many of the state house races. Do you have any suggestions, given our Constitution doesn't allow ballot initiatives. We have no way to address this outside of lawmakers. What other means do we have to bear outside of litigation to change how we redraw our congressional legislative districts?
Thanks, Rick. I mean, I feel like potentially Josh or Ben or Katie may be better than me. This is Ruth. We should talk afterwards so I can put you in touch with people in Illinois who have been working on this where we have a similar problem. And I think we should chat with some of Ben's colleagues in Pennsylvania about their legislative strategy, because basically outside of litigation or a constitutional amendment, you're looking at putting public pressure, right? Naming and shaming. Actually, there are some great groups in Virginia who've been doing the same thing. One Virginia 2021 have been trying to put pressure on all of the people before they even get elected to sort of commit to fair districts or to commit to putting a commission on the ballot the next time. So there are strategies. We should just talk through maybe with similar states to Indiana, what's been used in those states. I don't know, Josh or Katie or Ben, do you have anything to add?
This is Ben.
Thank you.
Thing I would add is that I don't know really any specifics about Indiana. Other than that, Indiana is one of the 12 states that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court identified as having identical wording in its state constitution.
Right.
As a free and equal elections clause. I know you asked about non-litigation solutions, but just wanted to mention that Indiana may be one of those states that might take a good close look at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Katie from Michigan. I think that, you know, redistricting is an issue that I think we consistently see that more and more people are starting to know about, but there's always more education that can be done. But even just trying to raise, if you have volunteers or you have people who are passionate about this, trying to get letters to the editor or just raising the public dialogue around it so it's part of the conversation and part of what people are talking about when they talk about, you know, what are the other issues that aren't being fixed in your state that you would like to be seeing progress made on, and being able to start tying that so that when people are upset about other things, then they go and talk to their legislators, they can maybe bring that up as well. So.
Thank you again.
And as a reminder to enter the queue, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Star 1 to enter the queue. And we have Tracy Weston from Common Calls. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Have any states tried to create a kind of an independent Blue Ribbon Citizens Commission to actually draw fair maps, and you going through the processes that have been described, open meetings around the state and so forth, to draw a fair map and then hold them up as a model of what could be done and hold the legislature's feet to the fire by pressuring them to do something similar? Because Texas doesn't have the ballot initiative process, and it has a very conservative state legislature, and state Supreme Court is all conservative.
This is Katie Fahey. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I know that there was so it wasn't through like an initiative or anything, but there was a group, but I think it was like a coalition that in our state, in Michigan, a couple of years ago actually did that. They went around, held public meetings, had like a commission simulation, and then also had people who would follow a similar path and then submit their own maps, and then they had a panel that ended up choosing the right one. And it actually was a student from one of the colleges who was the president of the Republican club that his map ended up getting chosen, and then there's a lot of press around it, and then he did submit it and show that it followed the exact same criteria that our legislators do and tried to adapt it. And although I don't think, I mean, it didn't result in them changing their ideas and they didn't end up choosing that map. What was really powerful was the amount of press and the amount of people who got involved, and especially around universities and different nonprofit organizations. So I know that was pretty successful here in Michigan.
And I would mention in Pennsylvania, there's a great group.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add that in Ohio, they did a similar a coalition kind of had a similar competition where they allowed the public to submit maps and they had a list of criteria. And then they scored all the maps, including the map drawn by the state legislature. And the state legislature's map was basically the worst map of all the maps submitted. And actually, an Illinois state legislator drew the best and most fair map and submitted it and won the competition. So kind of like Katie said, it's an excellent way to bring attention to the issue and kind of shame the legislature. And then that information can be useful later, for example, in court, because then there's a series of examples of more fair plans that could have been enacted but weren't.
And this is Ben from Pennsylvania. I just mentioned that there's a great group up here called Committee of 70 that started a project like that called Draw the Lines PA, and actually that's their URL, drawthelinespa.org, which is a competition for people to draw their own district maps for Pennsylvania, and they've done a great job spreading this around the state. There's a local software firm here called Azavia that has created software that's part of the Draw the Lines effort called District Builder, which is an open source software package that you can use through their website that makes it possible to draw lines according to all sorts of criteria. So that's another resource that's maybe a good role model.
Great. Thanks.
And our next question comes from Bob Ackerman. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm director of the Levin Center at Wayne Law, where we'll be presenting a symposium on gerrymandering in March. I also ought to say, by means of disclosure, that while I'm Michigan-based, I'm a previous resident of and still licensed to practice law in Colorado and Pennsylvania, so you're all near and dear to my heart. I have a follow-up to the question regarding the Kavanaugh nomination to the Supreme Court, and I'm wondering whether Arizona State Legislature v. Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission is now very much in jeopardy. It's a 5-4 decision that essentially holds, from my understanding, that Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution does not limit decisions regarding redistricting to the state legislature alone. But you've got a dissent written by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, and I'm wondering whether Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are going to be enough to upset that decision with severe consequences for all of these ballot initiatives.
Thanks, Bob. This is Ruth Greenwood. You are right that that was a 5-4, and the dissent from Chief Justice Roberts is quite concerning. I guess it's important to note that that case would only affect the ability to have independent commissions around congressional districts. Now, I say only, that's obviously a huge thing, and we would do everything we can to uphold the precedent. Let's not forget that all of the justices say they like stare decisis and they like to uphold precedent, and that is a very recently set case, I think 2011 or so. 2015. So we would hope that that precedent would stay on the books. If it doesn't, then you can still do you can still introduce commissions for state legislative districts via ballot initiatives. But it would mean that for Congress, we would actually need Congress itself to institute independent commissions for the drawing of congressional district lines in the states. And obviously, that's something that we have long supported. There are bills at the moment for multiple members to introduce independent commissions for congressional district lines that, you know, many groups support. But yeah, you're right that it is a potential. It is a worry, but we are doing everything we can to try to maintain the constitutionality of these really important independent commissions.
Well, it would take more than an act of Congress, though. It would take an amendment to the Constitution if that case is reversed, right?
Well, I think that, I mean, it depends on your interpretation of Article 1, but I think that there is a view that Congress is able to choose, it sort of has plenary power over congressional elections. And so you wouldn't need to amend the United States Constitution, I think at least. You could have Congress pass an act that says, you know, this is how congressional district lines that will be drawn. There'll be an independent commission that will be formed in this way. That could happen under Article 1, I think.
Boy, that sounds even more fraught than the principal question.
I'm not a Supreme Court justice, so, you know. I think getting as many of these commissions, you know, approved by voters and showing how successful and useful and wonderful they are will hopefully be a counter. I think that the Supreme Court is aware of, you know, what goes on out in the world, and hopefully seeing how supported things like the Arizona and California commissions are will be helpful to maintaining their constitutionality.
The court told us what they thought about stare decisis and reversing Abood a couple of weeks ago. That was a 9-0 case decided, 30 years ago?
Yeah, and I guess you could say Janus as well, 41-year precedent. Look, you know, it's hard to be an optimist in these times, but we must continue. I have a John Lewis tweet pinned to my wall to remind me that we shouldn't be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble.
And as a reminder to enter the queue, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Star 1, enter the queue, and we're standing by for more questions. And our next question comes from Lydia Ozuna. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is for Benjamin. You mentioned that there were 12 states mentioned that have the same verbiage in their constitution. I'm in Texas. I was wondering if Texas was one of them.
I don't believe that Texas is on that particular list. However, if I'm not mistaken, the Texas Constitution does contain an equal protection guarantee, a free expression and association guarantee. And so, again, the case that we brought in Pennsylvania asserted claims under those guarantees as well. Because the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled in our favor under the Free and Equal Elections Clause, they didn't reach those other questions. They simply just didn't address them. Nonetheless, we think there are strong arguments that can be brought under each of those. I don't know what Texas's jurisprudence has been under those clauses, but in Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court held 15 years ago that our state's free expression guarantee gives greater protections to citizens than the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And so that's a further important distinction that makes it possible for a state Supreme Court to have the last word on one of these matters. I don't know whether that's the case in Texas, but that's the sort of thing that I would look at first.
Hi, this is Annabelle at the Campaign Legal Center. I just wanted to add that we just released a report kind of following on the Pennsylvania litigation outlining partisan gerrymandering claims that you can bring under state constitutions, and it has a little appendix that lists the states with relevant provisions, and that report's available on our website, so that would be something you could use as a resource to look into Texas.
Thank you.
And that concludes the question and answer session. I'll now turn the call back for final remarks.
Okay. Thank you so much. Well, thank you, everyone, for calling in today. And thank you so much to our speakers for taking the time to do this. If you would like some more information, please visit our website, campaignlegal.org, for more information about fair maps and partisan gerrymandering. And the materials that were mentioned today on the call, the Independent Redistricting Commission report, as well as a report on state litigation, will be emailed to you if you have RSVP'd for this call within 24 hours, but they're also on our website. And if you have additional questions or would like any information or, you know, questions for any of the speakers on today's call, please email us at info@campaignlegal.org, and we will be able to pass on your questions and make sure they get answered. And if you're a member of the media and would like additional information, please email us at media@campaignlegal.org, and we will certainly get back to you. Thank you all so much, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation, and you may now disconnect.